Good evening and welcome to Out of Bounds. I'm Tish Perlman. My guest is Susanna Berryman. Berryman is an associate professor of theater arts at Ithaca College, where she teaches acting, voice, and directing. She has also directed many IC productions, including Skin of Our Teeth, Three Penny Opera, and The Magic Flute. As an actor, she makes her home at Ithaca's Kitchen Theater, where she has been seen in many stellar productions, such as Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf, Sylvia, and recently appeared in Tennessee Williams's The Glass Menagerie. Welcome to the show, Susanna.
Hi, thanks, Tish.
It's so wonderful to meet you, finally.
It's great to meet you.
Now you began your acting career in the fourth grade.
Yes, I did.
In a production of Sleeping Beauty. And since it seems to be the main thread that runs through your life, when do you remember that it became really serious for you?
Well, I very clearly remember when I was about 9 years old. One night, my parents had taken me to a community theater production at the Attic Theater in Appleton, Wisconsin. And it got me very excited, as going to theater always did at the time and still does. And I remember lying in bed that night crying, and my mother came in and said, "What's the matter, honey?" And I said, "Why don't they ever have any parts for kids?" So really, I've loved it since then. And just to take it back even a little bit farther, my mother said she knew I was going to be an actor when I was 9 months old, because we went to a movie theater to see Brigadoon, and she held me in her lap, and she said I stared raptly at the screen the entire time and never made a peep.
My goodness. Is she sure you weren't asleep?
I don't think so. I can still sing Waiting for My Dearie very badly.
Now, I've heard this from many actors. When I asked you to be on the show, you said you're extremely shy.
Yes, indeed.
And do you think that's an attribute that a lot of actors carry with them?
I do think so, and that's partly from talking to a lot of actors and acting students over the years. I think it's always, not always, but I think it's very often people who enjoy experiencing large thoughts, large emotions, but prefer to experience them through the lens of someone else's words.
So it's a way to bring your own character out, or to bury your own character.
Well, it's a way to discover everything about the human experience in very rich ways, but not necessarily have to. It's just a different kind of bearing your soul. Some people like to bear their soul as themselves, speaking on a street corner, you know, or playing the guitar, or painting paintings, or writing, or whatever. And this is just the kind that feels comfortable to me. I think in general, artists have a desire to bear their soul, but it's just what form that takes.
That's that's really interesting. Now, was it always your intention to direct?
No, that's something that kind of fell in my lap as a result of the work that I was doing at the college, and it's a different kind of enjoyment, different kind of process.
So while you have taken on these parts and been involved in theater, you never thought, oh, I could direct that better than he or she, and that wasn't the impetus behind it, huh?
I confess to having had that thought from time to time watching a play, but it wasn't my drive. Some people, you can tell, you know, you work with them as students or whatever, and you say, this is a director. And I don't think, either from the outside or from the inside, I would have said that about myself, but I've enjoyed learning the process and trying to.
And as someone who does direct and has been doing so now for several years, is it hard for you to take direction now from a director and let go of that role?
Oh, I hope not. I don't know if all of my directors would say it is or not, but I would like to think that, I mean, I'm sure that in some cases I have stronger ideas based on that work, but I would like to think that I just bring more to the table as an actor, because ideally a director's process isn't to obviously spoon-feed the actors everything that happens on stage, but to take that collaboration of ideas, which is one of the wonderful things about making theater, and select the ideas that they like that the actors bring.
So you've never had a little tug of war with the director and decided, oh, I don't know if I can work with somebody who won't listen to what I have to say since I
think,
also direct.
I think every actor who's ever acted has had some kind of little tug of war with the director over somebody sees it one way and somebody sees it another way. But the wonderful thing about collaborating and making theater together is that, you know, the next time you show up at rehearsal, everybody's coming to the table with a collaborative spirit and intention to make things work as a team and as a single organism, which is mm-hmm. one of the things I think is so great about theater.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And then the director usually wins, right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
mm-hmm.
That's
as it should be.
that does sound like as it should be. You list on your resume that you have done a few films. What was that process like?
Those were projects in which I had small roles, or in one case I was the extras casting director for a more sort of big ticket movie. But I would really say my involvement with that's been minimal. It's I guess the one thing that struck me from the really sort of more supported film that I worked on, technically supported film that I worked on, is that it must be a very seductive experience for actors to do movies, because people are fluttering around them holding light meters up to their head and stuff. And it's oddly sensual and meditative are the two words that I didn't expect to apply to it that I would. And then, of course, there's a whole host of sort of actor techniques that you have to adjust in order to be suitable for film. I'd like to know more about it.
It seems to me a stage actor has to be more bigger, you know, and,
sure.
and you have to tone it down to be in a film. And I think a lot of people don't know how to translate either, you know. A lot of film actors don't know how to do stage. It's a specific talent, I think.
One of our alumni was an extra in a Woody Allen movie one time, and he was seated just behind the principal actor in one scene, and he never really got to meet and talk to Woody Allen, but they kept on doing take after take after take, and every time they stopped, apparently Mr. Allen would come over and lean over and whisper in his ear, "Do less." He'd come back the next time, "Do less."
I can imagine that.
It took about five times being told that before he was able to really bring it down enough.
So you say you like collaboration in regard to theater. What else is seductive to you about this career?
I like very much being in a room, having a shared experience with a lot of people, where people are breathing together and exploring images together and exploring stories together.
Mm-hmm.
It's I'm not a churchgoer, and there's a spiritual component to practicing one's art in a room full of people, and that art that you practice strikes each audience member in an individual way, but there's a commonality to it.
Yeah. I did a bit of theater when I was younger, and what I loved about it was exploring the language.
I love that too.
And how to phrase,
and
how to, you can do so many things with one sentence, and just sort of explore all of that with language. It seems to me that the British actors do that more so than the American actors, in regard to using the voice and phrasing. And
I think historically that's been true. Boy, that really varies. I mean, there are certainly some wonderful American actors who really have a deep and abiding passion for language and an ability to explore and manipulate it with great, great success.
Mm-hmm.
I think in a lot of cases, actors grow up with a love of language, or they don't grow up with a love of language, and the ones who do grow up with a love of language, and maybe families who support that habit, have some facilities or have some range that possibly isn't accessible to other actors, but then other actors have ranges of things that language lovers don't necessarily.
Yeah.
You know, everybody has something, and everybody brings different things.
I understand. Now, do you think it's important for you to have remained a working actor in order to be a good director and teacher?
I certainly think it helps. I think every part of my career helps strengthen the other parts, and also just keeps me happier as a human being. And I think a happier human being is better able to practice their practice their craft, or whatever that craft.
But have you run in? Are there people who can actually teach acting without having never been one? Is that possible even?
Without having ever been one. I hate the word never, so I would imagine that it probably is possible. I certainly know that there are plenty of fantastic acting teachers who don't currently maintain an actor's practice.
Hmm.
I think there are a lot of ways to go about things.
Yeah. I would think the main point of teaching acting is to bring out people's souls in some ways, or personalities, and it'd be interesting. We will talk a little bit about how you approach that. But I know that you try to direct a play once a year, and you try to act in the kitchen theater once a year. Well, what are the different aspects that you look for when you're doing one or the other in regard to a script?
Well, to give a sort of a fast and dirty answer, I'd say that when in directing, I always think of it a little bit like a TV camera or something like that. And in directing, the camera is pulled way back so that one's primary, or my, I'll just speak for myself, my primary concern is the bigger picture. Mm. And as an actor, even though I also have to fit my role into the bigger picture as conceived by the director, I get to indulge in my passion for detail, because specificity is a really, I mean, specificity is important for directors also, but as an actor, I feel as if I get to spend more time with the camera really close up, and with the director, it's more pulled back.
So you have different reasons for picking different scripts depending on what your role is going to be.
Well, I don't get to pick the scripts that I act in for the most part. I mean,
But you don't take everything that's offered, right? You only accept roles that you're attracted to, I would assume?
Well, I've been very, very fortunate at the Kitchen Theater with Rachel Lampert, and also previously with Norm Johnson. We have had just wonderful collaborations. They have both been supremely kind in giving me more say in sometimes what roles that I play or don't play than many actors are fortunate to have, and it's just a wonderful thing.
Yeah.
I'm so grateful.
So after all these years, I would assume they call you up and say, Susanna, would you be interested in this, right? Offerings like that, before they've even, you don't have to go to casting calls.
I am very lucky that way. I count my lucky stars every day.
So let us talk a little bit about teaching, because I want to think about the first day of class. You've got these eager freshmen looking up at you. How do you begin to teach acting?
Well, may I talk about the first day I ever taught acting?
Yes. Oh, absolutely.
This was in 1980, and we were on the stage of the Horner Theater. I was at the freshman scene study class. I was fresh out of graduate school, and I had them all sitting in a circle on the stage, and I was talking about acting. And as we so often do, we have two tracks running. You know, one set of words is coming out our mouth, and then there's the little trailer thing that's running in the back of our heads the whole time. And so while I'm talking about acting, I'm thinking, first of all, I'm thinking, goodness, I actually do have things to say. I might really be able to impart some knowledge to these people. Oh, this is very exciting. I never dreamed it would feel like this. And then there's another track in my head that's going, they do what I say. I asked them to sit down in a circle, and they sat down in a circle. And now, look at their faces. They're all watching me. They're listening to what I say. Oh, my goodness. They're hanging on every word. I must be making some sense. And there was a very nice young man named Scott who was sitting next to me, and he was particularly rapt. He was staring at my face as if he'd like to just gobble it up. And I was so entranced by how keenly he was listening to me. And finally, I became aware of a sort of an energy coming from him as if he wanted to say something. And I said, Scott, did you have something you wanted to contribute? And he said, you have the littlest ears. So my first lesson was, things are not always what they seem.
And listening takes on a whole new aura.
But I didn't really answer your question about how to teach acting, and
you must have had to learn that through the years. There's no just one way.
Right. And I continue, I mean, from my, different people teach different ways, of course, and some people have a more set method that's more consistent. I tend to be a little more, and this is neither better nor worse, but it's the only way I know how to do it. I talk to different actors different ways. I think everybody must to a certain extent.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Susanna Berryman. She's an actor and an acting teacher up at Ithaca College. Another thing that I did want to ask you about in this same line of teaching, can you sense when you think someone's really got talent?
Well, again, that's rather individual. I can certainly sense the actors whom I find personally exciting. And those are not necessarily the actors who are going to be commercially successful, who are going to garner the most interest. If you put them in a room with 10 agents, you know, everybody's looking for different things. And the actors who are most exciting to me, I like intelligent actors. I like actors with a sense of language. I like actors who are thorough in what they do, are very empathetic, and who evidence a care for the characters that they're playing.
Mm-hmm.
Do you actually get people coming through who are bothering to go through all this process of learning and so on, who mainly just want to be famous nowadays instead of really learning art? That seems so prevalent in this culture right now.
I would rather say that we get people who are interested in learning the craft and want to be famous.
Mm.
And that proportionally, that might be in different measure. And as far as fame goes, I mean, they can have it.
I thought you were going to say they can wish all they want.
No. Some of them may well become famous, and more power to them.
So, why do you say that? You find fame something that you have never aspired to, huh?
No. I mean, I think what's good about fame is that it gives you the power to choose your projects. It gives you enough financial stability so that you can really focus on what you're doing. You don't have to be waiting tables or mm-hmm. tamping or something at the same time. But sometimes I'll hear things, forgive me, but on the radio, where somebody will say, we'll be talking about someone's nose job or someone's, excuse me, testicular surgery or something like
that.
Exactly. And I don't want people caring about that kind of detail in my life.
Well, I think some people who've become famous have been able to maintain a private life and haven't mm-hmm. gone there, like mm-hmm. Meryl Streep, and
right.
she's a great example of
mm-hmm.
such fame and such notoriety, who has kept mm-hmm. a private life
right.
all these years, which is quite remarkable
mm-hmm.
to me.
Yeah.
It really, to me, that would be something to aspire to.
Yes.
To be able to maintain a private life, because this fame
would sure be important.
So fickle, and it's so shallow, and it's, especially now.
And misleading. I would think it would be awfully misleading.
Yeah. Yeah. And so on the other hand, finding people who you think are talented, do you ever have people in your class that you know could never make it in acting? And do you take them aside and say, I'm thinking you shouldn't bother to go through this?
Well, I would never say to anyone, you can never make it in acting, because there's such a wide range of who makes it in acting out mm-hmm. there. And some people do. Mm-hmm. Some people who make it absolutely big in acting don't do the kind of acting that interests me personally, but they could buy and sell me 1,000 times, you know. and there are all kinds of different careers for actors. There are all kinds of different approaches, different ways of getting there.
Mm-hmm.
Some people roll out of bed in the morning and they're wonderful actors. Some people aren't such wonderful actors when they're 18, and they're wonderful actors when they're 35.
Mm-hmm.
And I've watched students come and go for a lot of years now, and I sometimes have a sense of something else that's trying to come out in a person, like a director or a writer or a social worker or something like that, you know. And my feeling about those people is that if they decide to explore that other side, that's thrilling, because I'm kind of the follow your bliss belief. I'm not one of those people who thinks that theater is the be-all and end-all and everybody should die trying to do it, you know, or else because it's the best. My feeling is that whatever is that inner essential sort of germinating energy in you is what's the best.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
If it's theater, then try to do theater. And if it's not theater,
I assume theater maybe has opened some people up to finding out where they really want to go.
Because I did theater too, and I
knew quite soon afterwards that broadcasting was something more suited to my personality
mm-hmm.
and to my voice. And
mm-hmm.
yeah, so it is. It's a springboard
mm-hmm.
for some of us
to
go there.
Definitely.
In theater. Yeah. So you've performed in tons of plays like Night Mother and The Glass Menagerie and stuff. Have you ever embodied a character that really changed your life and changed you in any kind of either fundamental or small way?
Golly. I think think every role must change a person, at least in some small way. I kind of believe that we all, this is going to sound so hippie, I can't stand it, but we all have everything in us. But in terms of human response, we all have the capability for any kind of human response. And I think I've certainly had occasions, particularly when, for one reason or another, I had been sort of repressing some range of human responses, and playing a character would open those responses up, and then I would discover that I really preferred to leave them open and not repress them anymore. So it's very freeing in that regard.
Oh, how interesting. And is there a particular part that you've played that you absolutely loved and you know, are so grateful that you played it? A role that has taken... I know you've done so many great roles.
Martha and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf was a big favorite.
Oh, yes.
Because the quality of that writing is so outstanding.
Yes, it's one of my favorite plays, too. Mm-hmm. I actually did a long scene from it when I was in high
school. Which one?
I played Martha.
Which scene, though?
Yeah, I don't remember now. Uh-huh. It's been a long time.
I played Martha in high school in a scene, too, and I'll tell you, I didn't know what I was saying most of the time.
Yeah. I didn't really either, but I was rehearsing in the back room of my house, and the neighbor called my mother to ask if we were having a fight.
That's a very good sign. You should be very proud of yourself.
But my favorite line from Virginia Woolf is, "I'd divorce you, George, if you existed."
Painful.
God, I love that line. It just says so much about so many of the characters.
Ooh, that's a horrifying line.
It wasn't. That is absolutely one of my favorite plays as well. Mm-hmm. I've seen it so many times. Yeah.
Cripple Finishmon was another favorite.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, they're wonderful. Doing a new play, I just recently finished Tony and the Soprano, a little ways back here. That was fun in a whole different way because, you know, it's being created from the ground up. And
yeah. Well, when that happens, when you do something, in this case by Rachel Lampert, mm-hmm. that's new, original, are you able to be part of the collaborative process? Because I know she works on these plays and does rewrites and stuff while you're doing them.
Sure. She has a very inclusive way of working, and she, mm-hmm. Both in creating the ideas for the scripts and also in the pursuit of rewrites, she certainly takes into account things that she thinks the actors are bringing and sort of represent to her.
Oh. God, that must be so interesting to create a character from nowhere. Because, you know, a lot of the roles, the traditional roles, we've seen people in them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to, you know, take Elizabeth
right.
Taylor out of
mm-hmm.
your mind when you think about Martha and Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf mm-hmm. and so on. So to create a character just from the ground up must be so exciting.
It's very exciting. And at my age, which is 52, it's particularly exciting because those memory brain cells aren't quite what they used to be. So rewrites, you know, when some playwrights like to use different colored pages, you know, so like you'll get the blue pages on Wednesday or something like that to show that there are rewrites and what pages to replace in your script. And you see the blue pages coming toward you and you think, oh, please let me dodge this bullet. Please let me dodge this bullet. I just finally learned that monologue.
Yeah, that must be frustrating, yeah, at some times. Oh, yeah. Now, whether you're playing a crazy person or, you know, a mean-spirited character or, you know, somebody who's naive, do you find that you need to find something that you like about this person in order to really
yes, of course.
Embody the character?
Yes, the classic sort of actor-teacher thing that people say over and over again as well, if you play a villain, you can't believe they're a villain. You have to believe that they're completely justified in everything that they do.
Mm-hmm. So you do have to find something to like about. I would assume so, too,
mm-hmm.
because you have to leave the surface and go into the depths
mm-hmm.
in order to create something authentic.
Otherwise, you're sort of playing two people at once. You're playing the character, and you're playing yourself, pointing at the character, saying, what a creepy person!
Now, you've done a bit of writing, you say, in your
strictly hobby and mostly journal, but go ahead.
Yeah. Well, I was just wondering if you think you might have a play in you somewhere.
Well, you'd think I would, wouldn't you?
Well, I'm asking.
That seems only logical. I'll tell you the one bit of dialogue that's been of use to anyone that I've written is that I've written some what we call open scenes or contentless scenes that are just scenes that don't have a particular set of given circumstances associated with them. There's no who, what, when, where, or why that is told ahead of time. And they're kind of flexible lines that could apply to a number of different situations. And I've written about, I guess, 19 of those, and we use them in freshman scene study class now as part of the semester's work. All the sections use them. So I enjoy writing dialogue, and maybe one day that play will pop out.
Yeah, I used to like to write monologues.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, you're
because
a good
there aren't that many
then.
Monologues for women that I cared for. A lot of them were these little. Put your hand on your forehead. He's left me.
Yes.
Are you somebody who loves Shakespeare as well?
I do.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare's monologues are fascinating.
Yes, they are.
Yeah. So we only have a minute or so left.
Okay.
What's the future looking like? Do you have anything cooking up in regard to directing or acting?
Well, in this spring I'm going to be directing a new musical of The Count of Monte Cristo written by a senior music student at Ithaca College. Mm. So that's kind of an unusual situation, and he's done a terrific job. He's written the book, the music, and he's orchestrating it. So that'll be my next project.
Uh-huh. Is that set in stone, or are you going to collaborate with him on actually shaping it, or is it set in stone?
That will continue to be shaped over the course of the production process by the whole team.
Uh-huh. And then what about any? Are we going to be able to look forward to seeing you perform anywhere?
You'll have to ask Rachel. I don't know the answer. I don't know the answer to that since Glass Menagerie has happened already for this year. I've kind of,
just have to wait and see.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. It's been such a pleasure to talk
much.
To you. And I really recommend, if my listeners out there have not seen Susanna Berryman in a play, next time she appears, go see her. She is terrific.
That's very kind of you, Tish. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Our audio producer is Nate Richardson at Rep Studio in Ithaca, New York. We are a project of the Women's Interfaith Institute in Seneca Falls. Our theme music was composed by Diego Vega. And log on to our new website at outofboundsradioshow.com. We'll be back next week. I'm Tish Perlman.